listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that gives you access to women who are contributing, inspiring, trailblazing, and disrupting the business of technology. We believe that when women inspire other women, amazing things happen. I'm your host, Allison Wade.
And I am your host, Jessie Sterenshuis, and we are connecting women around the world to share ideas that help us thrive and advance in our personal lives and in our careers.
Be sure to share this podcast with your friends, rate and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and help us bring Women Who Change Tech into the lives of more professionals.
Hold on to your seats as we give you a dose of inspiration from some of the most talented and creative women who are shifting the face of technology.
Hi, Jessie. How are you this morning?
I am doing great. How are you doing?
I'm great. I just got back from Agile Testing Days in Boston, and what a great conference it was. It was literally a magical experience.
Nice.
What an incredible group of people. It's just an amazing community. There was incredible speakers. It's like a giant festival, just so much fun.
And I hear there's lots of unicorns involved.
There absolutely are lots of unicorns involved. That's a long story as to how the whole unicorn thing evolved, but there is so much uniqueness about the testers that come to this conference and the other agilists that attend. And you would love it because we play a lot of games too. There were games nights where it was just hilariously funny. Have you ever played PowerPoint karaoke?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I love that game. That's like straight out of improv with the pictures and you're trying to make a presentation on pictures that you've never seen. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My first slide when I was doing PowerPoint karaoke, the subject I pulled was agile leadership. My first slide was a beaver.
Oh, wonderful. Perfect. You'll have to tell me more about that.
Well, naturally, I talked about backlogs.
Oh, naturally. Nice. Love
bada
it.
Bada bing.
Bada bing, bada boom. I'm here every night. That is great.
So since we last talked, you've been to my homeland.
I have. I love your homeland. Those Australians, they're the best. I got to give a keynote at Agile Australia, Unlearning the Challenge of Change. And then I got to lead two workshops as well. And I just had an incredible time there. The people were wonderful. The event was wonderful. The whole shebang was great.
That's great. Those Australians, they really are great, even if I do say so myself.
Yes, you can toot your own horn because it's valid.
Today, we're going to be talking to another awesome person. That is Jennifer Bonine. She is the best. I know that you met Jennifer in Agile DevOps East in Orlando. She's an incredible speaker and leader, and I can't wait to talk to her today.
Definitely. I loved meeting her. She's the kind of person who makes you feel like you've known her forever, even though you just met her 2 seconds ago. She's incredibly charismatic, so I'm excited to have her on our podcast.
Me too. Let's introduce Jennifer. So I wanted to introduce everyone to Jennifer Bonine, our guest today. She's a woman who embraces change. I first met Jen in, I think, in about 2005 when she was working for Oracle, and she gave some talks at our conferences on leading and embracing change. And Jennifer, you went on to work at TapQA, where you are the VP of Global Delivery and Solutions. And you started giving talks at both our STAR conferences and Agile Development conferences on what's your leadership IQ, the lost art of communication. And in 2015, you started giving talks on Women Who Test, on building your own personal brand. And I know you know my co-host, Jessie Sterenshuis, because you met her at the Agile Development Conference in East in Orlando in 2018. So you guys know each other. So welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jess and Allison, for having me. It was a pleasure to get an opportunity to spend some time chatting with both of you. So I'm excited to be here today.
Thanks. So we wanted to jump in and just kind of hear about your career path. So where you've worked and what you've been doing in the tech world and what you're currently doing. So can you give us a little bit of background?
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting. When I went to undergraduate, I was all about international business, and working and living abroad was kind of my dream or goal at that time. So I focused everything around business. I worked and lived in London for a period of time during my university days, embracing other cultures and being overseas, and came back and went to work for Accenture. So at the time was Arthur Andersen, one of the larger consulting firms, to get a lot of exposure to different companies. And through that exposure, I really learned that I wanted to try different industries. And one that really spoke to me in the tech space was retail. And I did quite a bit of work in the retail space, building teams for organizations. And the interesting thing, very early on in my career, so after Accenture, because of the tech boom and where the industry was at that time, it was apparent that what we were lacking was people with natural leadership skills and talents. And so where I found my niche was really building teams for organizations around the tech community and then leading teams around the tech community. And I was in my very early days of my career, so 2-3 years out of college in my university days. And I was already thrown into roles of like director and senior leadership positions at a very early age, leading people who were much more technically savvy, obviously, than I was, not having grown up with a computer science degree. So quickly learned that my value was going to come from my ability to remove roadblocks, help others be successful in their jobs, and not from actually being the one to implement the code or program or do any of that. And then that really carried with me through the rest of my career. I went on to work in several different industries, worked at Oracle for some of their top leadership and executives, interfaced at Oracle with executives who led companies like Hewlett-Packard, Dell, a lot of the big names you hear. Those were the people I would interact with day in and day out. That's really where I blended my love of international community and international business. Traveled to most of the Brazil, Russia, India, China countries, the BRIC countries, as we call them in tech, putting in new solutions around big data, around artificial intelligence, what was happening in that space, and staying really cutting edge on where people were going. And then most recently, I have two small, as I call them, tiny humans. With the introduction of those tiny humans, it makes it less possible. I'm sure a lot of people out there who have children understand it's fabulous to travel and live that life of you don't know where you're going to be next week and you get a call on Saturday and they say, can you be in Japan on Monday? And that works for you. But as I had those tiny humans, that just was not in the cards for me anymore. And so I looked at something that allowed more flexibility, but yet the impact that I would still get to impact the lives of many different organizations, the lives of many different people. So I moved to a QA-focused organization called TapQA about almost 6 years ago now to accommodate my family life and my personal life with my career in tech.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And how do you feel having made that change?
It was brilliant for me. It came at a time in my life about 6 years ago because I started my career at such a young age in leadership, I always felt, I don't know if we've ever felt this or any of you have felt this, but this imposter syndrome, they call it, mm-hmm. of never being worthy of the job or the title that I had because I was so much younger than everyone else, or I hadn't done that long enough, or whatever. In my head was always, I'm not worthy. So I would work 3 times as hard. I would spend weekends learning about stuff. I would educate myself. So I just totally embraced and threw myself into my career in the early days before my children. And I was really at a point where I needed to step back and go, wow, I've done a lot. Like mm-hmm. I'm okay in this space and it's okay for me to be in the position I'm in and embrace it. And not always have to prove that I'm good enough to do it.
Yeah.
So it was a perfect move because it really forced me out of that constant proving that I was worthy. And in my new job 6 years ago, I set some parameters, which I encourage all of you to do with your careers, where I said, you know what? I drop my kids off in the morning and I eat breakfast with them. So I'm available most times, but there are certain times that these tiny humans are going to get from me and I'm not available for career, right? I'm going to work from home when I need to sometimes. Those types of parameters were really important. And that change allowed me to embrace that part of my career.
Yeah, that's amazing. So Jen, in your new role in QA, I know you've been in QA for the last 6 years. I know that you're giving a keynote at the Star West Conference on the life of a software tester. And the talk is A Life of a Software Tester from Once Upon a Time to Happily Ever After. So in your career in QA, have you seen a lot of changes in the role of testers and what's happened and what have you seen and where do you think it's going and how do you think it's affecting the role of in testing?
Oh, definitely. Some of the first organizations I built very early in my career were companies where they were not very mature in what they were doing around software testing, and they didn't have the discipline of treating it as a career path. There weren't necessarily job titles specifically for those individuals. What you used to see years ago was those folks a lot of times were really good business people or they had subject matter expertise. We used to call them SMEs or subject matter expert. And they came from the business side. They maybe didn't have technical backgrounds. And because they were really good at using an application, they were like, you know how to use it. Let's have you test it. Right?
Yeah.
And then if they weren't that, a lot of times what I would get in my organization from my peers who were development managers and development directors was, hey, Jen, we've got a developer who's not a good developer. Maybe he's a good tester, right?
Yeah.
So I'd get the cast-offs from other teams. And what it used to be, I think years and years ago, as before testing started to get more traction and more visibility and more respect, frankly, for individuals that do this as a career was, it was kind of the land of misfit toys. You would get lots of different people from different walks of life who, for whatever reason, wandered into this role and were now there trying to figure it out. And what we're starting to see with maturity, with understanding how complex software has become, with understanding how complex our world is getting, companies knowing that everyone is a technology company now. Right. It used to be that companies were like, well, we're healthcare or we are a toy manufacturer. Right. But even all of those folks have realized what really drives at the end of the day is reach to their consumer, which involves websites and mobile applications and gamification and lots of other components that center around technology. And so with that change has come a little more placement of focus or emphasis on how important people who test those interfaces, those applications, those websites are. So it's gaining a lot more traction, a lot more importance. People now have career paths. They're looking at them to have technical skills, right? So besides just business knowledge, can you actually do automation? Can you write performance scripts? Can you automate those? There's a lot more tools that they're looking for the testing team to have, as well as it used to be the testers were kind of segregated from the development staff where it was literally in our presentation, we talk about like the proverbial brick wall.
Yeah.
And on one side was everyone else. And on the other side were these testers that you kept segregated, that you threw things over the wall, literally. And they were behind that wall running back and forth, trying to figure out when something would come over, how big it would be, trying to catch it before it fell on the ground, right? It was this very isolated experience. And now we're much more integrated with Agile. Those testers sit side by side with their developers. Instead of it being, we don't know what you're doing or what you're going to test, we're shifting left. We're having testers start at the beginning and say, hey, developer, here's what I'm going to test. And the developer is engaged directly with the tester, sometimes doing paired automation while they're writing their development code. The testers have gotten a lot more respect with some of the major incidences we've seen in the world with healthcare.gov and that site not being up and not being tested properly, with things like Target's incident and breach, Equifax's breach. It's just getting a lot more visibility. And now most organizations have come around to saying, I need to get good at this thing that's testing and I need to have professionals that understand it. And that's an important thing in my organization.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And as you said, we're becoming a nation of software. You know, everybody's doing it and testing's become more and more important. I know there's a lot of fear in the testing community about AI and how that's going to affect humans. Do you want to touch on that just a little bit to talk about what you think that how that's going to evolve the tester's role?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time with some of the folks that are on the bleeding edge of that type of technology, with Jason Arbon and Tariq and others, talking to them about how they see that evolution. And the interesting thing is that no matter what we develop, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's virtual reality experiences and engagement in how we engage with our technology, all those things, in order to be valid, have to be validated manually by a human, right? Someone has to ensure that what automatically is being done works when you take away the automatic nature of what it's doing. So there's still a component of someone has to check and validate that the AI and the algorithms and all the things that they're doing are in fact giving you the correct result. And then the other piece is, there frankly is just a lot of stuff that even if a bot checks on a website, for example, for basic changes and differences, you still want a human to say, do I need to do 15 clicks and would two have been easier and how do you optimize it? So I think
absolutely
what it'll further just shift. And I call it, what's going to happen is testers, instead of just being functional testers or automation testers, they'll become artisanal testers.
Ooh,
right?
I like that.
Yeah. And that's kind of my new term I'm using for it, of is artisanal testing. And it's that artistic nature and creative nature of what only humans can bring in their logic and reasoning that artificial intelligence will never have, like we have.
That's terrific. So now that we've established testing's not going anywhere, and we're talking specifically to all testers in general, but specifically to women in this podcast, talk about, we work on our technical skills all the time, but there's also these other skills that we have in our lives that we want to improve: our communication skills, our leadership skills. And you talk about leadership IQ. Can you explain to us what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that served me very well, again, throughout my career, was understanding the way that I like to get information and to communicate information may be very different than someone else I'm working with. So what I learned early on was the ability to understand other people's preferences for how they communicate, how they interpret information, how they like to get direction and information is very critical and important. And understanding personality types and styles, very important. So what I talk about in Leadership IQ is, to be a good leader, you need to adapt and understand the person you're communicating with and what they need from that communication that may be very different from the person sitting next to them. So not having just one way you show up or one leadership style, but true successful leaders understand how to adapt their content, their message, anything they're communicating to the audience, and specifically the person that they need to communicate to. The other piece to that, besides understanding personality styles and types and getting real comfortable with that, is understanding how to read and assess body language. There's a lot of things people are telling us through their body language that if you do some research and knowledge, gaining knowledge on what body language is telling you about what the person thinks, can help you in terms of interpreting things they may not verbally tell us all the time. So there's a couple of key skill sets that I touch on for individuals on refining and honing and being observant, picking up clues from things in the environment that you may not know. Like when you walk up to someone's desk, what do they have on their desk? Do they have pictures of their family or is there nothing? Those types of clues give you indicators, again, of what that person wants to see in terms of how they're communicated with and what they need to be successful. Mm. So I think we spend a lot of time in those classes on what type are we? Because the first step of understanding others is knowing your strengths as a leader, knowing where your blind spots are. So we talk about strengths, and then we also talk a little bit about where your blind spots are, because we all have them, right? So where are those, and how do you find a buddy or a mentor that can help you with those blind spots? Because when you run into an issue, you turn to them and go, hey, this isn't my area of strength. What would you do in this situation?
Mm-hmm. How can you help people understand what their strengths and gifts are?
There's a couple of ways to do that. I mean, one of the easy ones I do in the class is a very quick one page. Here's some words. What do you identify with? What feels most like you? Mm-hmm. And it's a quick one page, circle the words that you identify with, mm-hmm. and then rank them. And it gives us kind of a basic understanding of the type of personality they have, mm-hmm. the type of communication they probably prefer. And once I get there, I can start drilling into, if this feels like you and you kind of are aligning to this particular style or bucket, here's some things that that means to think about. And then we can refine down there further. But there's tools out there that are as simple as a one page. Lots of organizations today use Myers-Briggs and Insights and lots of different assessment tools. But the one I prefer is colors. People on average remember four things. So the one I use is red, yellow, blue, green for styles. Limits it to four. Everyone's good with colors. It's one of the first things we learn when we're tiny.
Yeah.
So it's easy to remember, mm-hmm. right? Instead of a bunch of letters or combinations. And then I find whatever sinks in, like the colors seem to sink in for the majority of people out there and they remember it. Mm-hmm. That's what I want, is them to take something away that they can go, okay, that landed with me. And 2 years from now, when I see them, they'll go, oh, remember, I'm red, blue, right? They mm-hmm. still remember it.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's a great way to think of others too. When you're talking to them, you're like, oh, I'm red, blue, and they're green, yellow. So that's clearly I need to use the green, yellow skills to communicate with that person, right?
Well, and we do it in organizations I work in. It's really nice too, where when you're sending an email and you're sending it to someone who's a very different style than you, and maybe say they're a pretty direct, aggressive style, and you're trying to be very empathetic, you can send at the top of the email, I'm being green, I need you to listen and pay attention. Whereas normally someone who's more direct is more red, and they'd go, I'm not reading that, it's too much to worry about. But that triggers in their head, oh, I need to be empathetic, I need to pay attention, I really need to focus on this.
Nice, I love that. So do you feel like some of the things that you discovered that you were good at in your career early on, like those soft/very hard skills, were things that now help you in terms of like helping other people with their leadership IQ?
Oh, absolutely. And it is, I think, very powerful. And this is something I learned from my father when I was growing up as a child. He was a teacher. And he loved what he did and he embraced and found his passion, and his passion was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that he told us very young was find your passion, find what you love doing, what gets you up every day and drives you to do that. And when you do, that's what your gift is. And once you know what your gift is to the world, you can take that out to other people mm-hmm. that don't have that same gift and give it to them. Mm. And so I viewed it very early on in my career that I found that was where my talent and my gift was. So I needed to practice, focus, refine, and hone in on that. And I still, 15, 20 years later, have people coming back that literally were rocket scientists who'd been in their career for 15, 20 years when I was leading them at 25 years old and say, I remember how you led us. I remember how you removed roadblocks. I remember how you supported us. But yet, technically, they were rocket scientists with 15 to 20 years of experience. And I'm a 25-year-old kid. They probably were like, who let Doogie Howser in, right? Like, it doesn't make sense. Why? But that's why you have to find what that gift is. And then other people see it and go, oh, that's their gift. I need to learn that piece, just like I needed to learn very important things from all of them.
Mm-hmm. And so does it feel good to be helping other people find what those gifts are in them that may not, have been raised by somebody like your dad and uncovered those things for them?
Yeah, no, I always said, besides leading organizations, and my main goal with everyone I worked with, all of the employees that I worked with, was really to get to know them, mm-hmm. get to know their strengths, help them find their strengths. Mm-hmm. And then I really viewed myself in the tech world as a matchmaker, right? So I would match their strengths and talents to the right projects and jobs to get the optimal output to create really high performing teams. And that was my job.
I love that.
That's such an important skill too, because so many times you see people sitting in roles that they're unhappy in, but yet they're still a valuable employee. So finding that like right seat on the bus for people can be life-changing for them, but so great for your organization.
Well, yeah, it helps both, right? And now with where we sit today with record low unemployment and a technology and a technology shortage of qualified people and talent to be in those roles, I think it's even more important that organizations have people that's their job is figure out people's strengths, find the things they do well, and leverage that to its fullest capability.
Right. It seems like in a lot of large companies, and I think things are getting better, but in a lot of large tech companies, the only way to move up the career ladder was to be in management.
Yeah.
And so many of those people's strengths are not necessarily in the people skills, right? And so they would rather be kind of like hacking away and doing coding and development and testing, but their only way to move up was to go somewhere with strengths that they lacked.
Yeah.
And so then you see these very mismatched career paths and people are like, I'm miserable. I don't want to be managing people, but it was my only way to like further my career. So it seems like.
That's a good question for both of you. Yeah. I mean, you guys spend a lot of time in a lot of other companies. Have you seen that change over the years, you know, where you just don't have those people that it's really not their skill and they don't really want it to be their skill, but they kind of have to have it be their skill. Have you seen changes going on?
Yeah, I think what's happening now, at least even years ago, what I proposed because I saw that, it's like for folks out there, the Peter principle, right? So if you look at the Peter principle of management, it was promote people to their first level of incompetence, right? So you get promoted because you're good at something, not necessarily what you're being promoted to, but because you were good, we're going to promote you. Because you did okay at that, we'll promote you to something else, right? And then as soon as you're bad at it or you don't succeed, we stop promoting it, right? Mm-hmm. So now we've left you in your first area of incompetence and are just leaving you there to flounder.
Right.
When instead, what we should be doing is evaluating the individual and saying, where are those gifts? Where are your talents? What gets you excited about coming here every day? What are the career paths that you fit? And one of those may be really experienced individual contributors who can continue to grow and become strategists and architects and other things, but you don't have to lead people because that's not your gift. And then there's another career path for those minded around, you know, leading and who have great gifts around leadership. And then there's another path around people who are great strategists for products and technology ideas and proof of concepts and things like that. So creating these diverse career paths that still feed what organizations need is really going to start to differentiate the companies that are seeing success and the companies that are really struggling with the wrong people leading and not motivating organizations.
Yeah, I completely agree. I feel like there's still leaps and bounds for a lot of companies to go and make those kinds of changes because I think they need to see that they have wins, you know, small wins. If they start to make that kind of transition in the way that they have career paths inside of the company. But I think there's that. And there's the fact that even school systems just kind of fit us all into one category and either you're good at that or you're not. And there's only one way to move up. So I think a combination of shifting and transitioning companies to allow people's gifts and talents to rise, but also like having people understand what their gifts and talents are to begin with is also an issue that needs to be dealt with because many people don't realize even what they're good at or that what they're good at has any worth.
Yep. I would say that's so true. And even at the conferences, all the TechWell events and stuff, I always find it interesting that, you know, you'll see classes like how to implement Selenium or how to code in Java, right? Those fill up in there. Sold out, but yet you give someone the opportunity to focus on what are my strengths? What does that look like? What is my style? What is my personality? And like you said, the what people consider, I guess, soft skills, but they're the hard skills. There's less people that do those things. But in general, what I'm seeing as a trend is technical skills. People get lots of exposure, training, opportunities in that. But I think the other needle mover will be companies that realize soft skills, communication, leadership, all of those things are as important as your technical skills to deliver quality products with the velocity and speed that they're looking for.
Right. And yeah, and that goes back to, you know, those things like empathy and understanding what language each person speaks and uncovering all those things. Like, that's where typically the problems unfold when those things aren't in place.
Yeah. Well, and it's another interesting part on that one quick thing was just with the financial collapse and crisis that we had, some of the articles and information I was reading said that part of what happened to us as a society was we let the drivers, so the red personalities, drive all of us, and the greens, who have that empathy, that desire to see what happens 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, not just today or tomorrow, weren't speaking up. And we lacked that balance in corporate America. You'll even see the articles about we lack the balance of the male-female personas in corporate America and leadership. And the idea of the defiant woman statue that was put at Wall Street after the financial collapse to say, we as people need to make sure that our board of directors, that our executives, that our CEOs are representative of both male and female persona, not just one, right? Because there is a different way that those personas view the world and see implications of decisions being made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think we've seen, and it's been well documented now, software failures where the female portion of the user community was not considered, and not considered by having any female developers, not considered by having any female testers. And that's led to products that did not work for the primary buyer, who might have been a woman, and products that didn't technically work. I mean, I know I can think of a large voice over IP company that basically tested all of their voice recognition using males. And then when they launched it, they could not, the software had trouble interpreting female voices. I mean, that's a classic example of not creating diversity in your users and not creating software for half of the world.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think it's something we all have to be cognizant of. I know we're all careful of, we don't want to isolate based on gender, but at the same time, we have to be cognizant of, there are some inherent differences with female and male persona, just in general of the persona. Whether you identify with the male persona or the female persona based on whatever gender you are, there are differences.
Yeah. So at the Women Who Test, which, speaking of women, at Women Who Test, the day that we do at the STAR conferences, you've been a speaker, and Jen's had the both amazing and dubious task of wrapping up the day every single time. But we keep her in that slot because she does this amazing talk on branding, and it's so useful. And I literally have women call me, phone me, come up to me at the end and say, oh my God, that portion, like, I love the whole day, but that portion just kind of wrapped it up in a bow for me and really changed my life. Because you talk about every day we think, we go to work and we think about the job that we do, but we so infrequently think about our careers as a path for us. And we spend more time planning our vacation, as I like to say, than we do planning our careers. And then you're not really thinking, women in particular tend not to think of themselves as a brand, and how you create that brand and how you market that brand and how you change your career path based on where you want to go and what you want to be. So can you tell us a little bit about what you talk about in that and what personal branding means to you and means to other people?
Yeah. Where this really came from was when I did make that shift from Oracle, big tech company working with, I mean, I would look around a room, and at Oracle, I always say the brand is red for a reason. Oracle's a driver. You see, when most candidates for presidential election in the US run for election, whether they're male or female, the power color is red. So red is a power color. I worked for a power color organization. and started heavily to identify as, in order to get anything done, I need to get rid of my empathy. I need to get rid of my can't do this or balance in my life. I need to just push ahead. And I'd really lost a lot of what do I love? What drives me every day? What gets me excited about going to work? What do I want to be doing? And really took a sabbatical and stepped back. And I was forced to do that because my father, who I mentioned earlier, is one of the key people in my life and one of my biggest influencers. I remember getting a call from my mother saying he'd been diagnosed with cancer. And I'm the oldest of three girls. And I immediately said, how do I get home? I think at the time I was overseas in Asia. And I'm like, how do I get home? Right. Mm-hmm. And that was my number one priority. And just hearing that news about someone who is so impactful in my life was my reset. I needed to say, where am I in my career? What do I want? What boundaries and parameters do I need to put around it? Because when I looked back, I had spent most of the first part of my career letting jobs or individuals drive where I was going. So if I would have used the analogy of being in a car, I was literally sitting in the passenger seat, letting someone else drive that career, drive that direction, and tell me where I needed to go next. And I looked and said, nope, my turn, right? I need to drive this brand. I need to drive where it's going. I want to set the standards on what that looks like and how I help. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not collaborative and I don't want to work with people and I'm not going to add value and be impactful, but I'm going to do that in a different way. So I take the women through an exercise of first closing their eyes, meditating, focusing a little bit, getting quiet. A lot of us just don't get quiet anymore. When we think about how often do we just sit with no distractions, no cell phones, no children, no significant others, no computers, no technology, and just think.
Once a year?
Yeah, right? Or some people never, right?
Like at Women Who Test when Jen does this exercise.
No, but it's true. And so I ask people to get quiet, which is ironically harder than you think. And then I ask them to take this placemat of pictures that's just for inspiration and throw down, if you were at a reunion 5 years, 10 years in the future, what would you be telling people about what you're doing? What are you passionate about? What do you want to be doing? If you can't use your job title as the descriptor, what do you say? Right? And that makes people think. And then we start refining that. And we talk about now, once you kind of refine and hone in on who am I? What do I want? What's the impact I want to leave on this world, right? What do I want my remembrance to be when people think about me? What do I want them to remember about what I did? And so often, if we think about it, all of us are so caught up every day in, I'm delivering this project. I need to go to this project meeting. We need to do this. We need to do that. And then when we look back, we go, how important was that? On the big picture, right? And then you see that companies will lay people off or cancel projects. And you've wrapped yourself into that project, that company, that whatever. And all of a sudden that identity is gone. I want people to have their own brand, their own identity, their own ability to say, if that stops, that's okay. I've got five people I'm going to call. Here's my next thing that I want in life. Here's what my brand is doing. Here's who I'm going to reach out to help me with that. I want their LinkedIn profiles, their social profiles, everything they do to be about talking and telling everyone they know about what that brand is, what it means, and what their next step is so that they're really driving those steps and that brand and how it looks and how it functions for their everyday.
Yeah, I think.
And then you make, I was just going to say, Allison, and then you make choices, right? You go, when someone says, hey, can you do this? Instead of like most of us do, where we always want to say yes, usually, right? We want to be like, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah.
You actually look at it against your brand vision and say, does this feed my brand or does it
yes.
hurt?
Yeah, that's awesome. I think one of the things that you say in that is like prepare your like elevator pitch so that you could say in a really short time frame who you are and what it is that you want to do in this world and how that you can use that sort of elevator pitch to sort of drive and constantly remind you and then remind other people about what you're good at or create an elevator pitch. Maybe that's not about where you are now, but where you want to be. And so every opportunity you get to tell other people you work with and other people in your life, this is who I am. Even if it's not quite where you are now, it's where you want to be. You're constantly reinforcing that with other people.
Absolutely. Yeah. So important, because you never know. Life is so connected in ways we don't understand that a lot of times by having that elevator pitch you mentioned, you'll tell that to someone and it could be a year later, it could be 2 years later. They're doing something, they remember that, and they connect you to what could be your next career, your next opportunity, your next big thing, right? Mm-hmm. But if you never say it, you miss that chance.
Yeah, I like to think of it too, like, once you really know what those things are, you end up seeing those things in life. So it's kind of like, I don't know. So when I was pregnant, it's like I all of a sudden saw all these other pregnant people, you know, yeah. And yeah. They were always there before.
Like, wow. I never knew this existed.
Right. But it's like you're hyper-focused on what it is you're going through or what it is you like. And all of a sudden you then notice those things too, because your focus is different. So if you understand who you are and what your brand is, then you will connect with those things that might already be there that you would have otherwise never seen.
Absolutely. So true. I mean, all of that is, that's exactly how it is. And the other thing I would say too is it's okay if your brand changes, just like you were pregnant. And now when you're not pregnant, it's okay to not be pregnant anymore. Right.
Yes, very okay, actually.
Right. So that's the key thing too, is brands can evolve so regularly. Taking a look at it and going, hey, am I different than I was before? It's okay. Let's re-evolve the brand and update it. Let's refresh, right?
Right. Definitely. So what do you say we play a game?
I would love that.
Hey. We know, Jess, you like games.
Yeah. Can we play a game, please? So as you were talking, I was thinking of kind of different experiential games that you could use to kind of make those points around brand or understanding who your audience is and what language they speak and knowing how to change those things up. So I keep thinking about this game that's called No Letter Blank. And what it is two people or three people can have a conversation. However, you can't use a certain letter in any of the words that you say. And the whole idea is that people speak different languages. So this makes you A, think before you speak, and B, see that there's alternative ways to say the same thing to get your point across, which is really helpful when you're, say, a business person speaking to a software developer or something like that. So should we try the game?
Yes. So remind me again. So no, you can't say the certain letters we're not going to be able to say, correct?
That's right. So for instance, if I say you can't use the letter M as in Martian, right? Mm-hmm. So if we were to talk about what we've been up to this week, we are trying to have a regular conversation. However, none of the words that we use can include the letter M in them. So if we hear,
right.
Yeah, it's fun. So if we hear,
That's one word for it, Jess.
Yeah, or torture.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm actually terrified.
Yeah, right. Perfect. Right, that's the way you should be. So, and if we hear you use the letter M, we can go, eh, and then you have to figure out another word to say. So it's perfectly fine to mess up and just go backwards and figure out another word. And if you're stuck, then we'll just move forward and say something different. So you want to try? No M's?
So Jennifer, you go first.
So I'll start by asking you a question.
Oh yeah. Okay, go.
So what have you been up to this week?
I have been busy talking to new potential clients and helping them with some of their challenges.
Them. So help.
Oh, it can't have M anywhere in the
right,
word?
Anywhere in it at all. So
I thought just the first letter.
Nope. Anywhere.
But you were doing great, Jen.
You were doing perfect.
Like 10 words out before you said M.
Look at you.
And I misunderstood the directions. Okay. No M anywhere in the word.
No M anywhere. It's complete torture, but I'll give it a try.
And helping people with challenges.
Great. And Allison, what have you been up to?
Well, Jess, that's a really hard question. Because I'm not allowed to say a certain letter.
True.
But I have been playing and working really hard. I've been spending a lot of hours dedicated to wrapping up the first half of the year and proceeding to plan for the future.
Ooh, sounds great. Are you feeling good about what you have done so far?
Yeah, the first half of this year was pretty incredible. It was really good and productive and satisfying. Our conferences were incredible. I met some incredible people. And
we can end there. Your brain was stretched. You're welcome.
Yay. So that's awesome.
That was awesome, Allison. You did really well.
You both did really well. So that's an exercise you can use to really make the point of finding alternative ways to say something when you need to get the same message across, but not necessarily in the same way that you've done it before for a different audience.
I love that, Jess. The other piece I love about that I find most of us are not good at naturally, is actually listening to what someone else is saying. Mm-hmm. We're usually formulating what we're going to say.
Yeah.
So we truly don't listen. And I love that because it forces you to focus and listen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's the empathy piece, right? And like such a key piece of communication that people are missing. So that's why there's two jobs, right? So the people who are not speaking have the job of being like, but it's about being present and really paying attention to every single word somebody is saying, it and not to be critical of the other person, but just to be playful. But really, we're practicing active listening.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually did that a lot in college because I took some applied psychology and we used to do triads with active listening. So you'd have a speaker and then a listener, but then a third party who was kind of doing the active listening, and then everybody would retell the story afterwards. Mm. And it was amazing. The person that was just listening to the conversation heard like twice as much as the giver and the receiver, so to speak. Because when you're talking and you're exchanging, you're sometimes thinking ahead and not being very present, right? You're thinking about what you're going to say or how you have an emotional response to what someone's saying to you. And then you're not being truly present. But when you're truly present, you can actually hear and listen to what people are saying and get their intent and not your own bias, right?
Exactly. And what I like is that these are things people can practice too, right? So these skills are necessary as the human part becomes more and more and more important in the way, like you said, an artisanal tester, right? So like paying attention in a way that only a human can, and that can be practiced. It doesn't have to be either you're good at it or you're not.
I agree.
So Jane, at the end of our podcast, we always like just to do a little wrap up to give you the opportunity to talk about what are you doing next and what's coming up for you and where people can find you and what you'll be doing. So we'd love to hear from you about what's next for Jennifer Bonine.
Yeah. So next for me, where I'll be is the fall conferences for TechWell. So I'm very excited about the joint presentation and keynote with a former Disney employee. And I'm really excited. The thing I like to tell people is our slides and some of our animations were actually done by Floyd Norman. And Floyd was the first African-American animator for Disney. So there are custom designs and animations that he did for our keynote. So that's going to be really fun. So I want everyone hopefully to tune into that. Even if you're not in person, we hope you are. But if you're virtual, tune in for that keynote because that'll be some only once ever seen animations from Floyd. So that'll be fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then I'm continuing just in general to work with a lot of fun companies and organizations across the U.S., helping them with their leadership, with their challenges around technology and testing. And so you'll see me show up a little bit there just regionally and locally for a lot of organizations and companies, just spreading the word on brand and leadership and a lot of the things we talked about today.
That's great. Thank you so much for spending the time and sharing your story and your journey with us.
No, it was a pleasure. Like I said, talking to you two ladies, I love it. I love the opportunity to do it. I hope I get invited back someday.
Absolutely. We'll do this again.
For sure.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Jesse. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will look forward to talking to you again next time.
Bye, everyone.
I really loved speaking to Jennifer today. Didn't you think she had so many takeaways?
Oh my gosh, she's a wealth of knowledge.
She really is. So there were a couple of things that stood out to me. I loved what she said about leadership IQ and understanding how people communicate in different ways and how important that is. And then she talked about understanding your personal brand and making sure that you align decisions to your personal brand and you're in alignment with those things so that you know what makes sense and what doesn't. But I think the thing that really stuck out the most was when she introduced us to the concept of artisanal testing. What do you think about that?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I love the concept of artisanal, although I have trouble saying it, testing. The idea that machine learning will not replace testers, I think, is really important to the testing community. And that whole concept just reinforces the fact that you can train a machine and an algorithm with a set of specifications, but when was the last time you got the exact right specs for a product or something that you're testing? And there's always needs to be context. And that's where the artistic side, the human side of software testing comes in. And that's not going away. So I would love it if we replay that section on artisanal testing.
Sounds good.
And I know there's a lot of fear in the testing community about AI and how that's going to affect humans. Do you want to touch on that just a little bit to talk about what you think that how that's going to evolve the tester's role?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time with some of the folks that are on the bleeding edge of that type of technology, with Jason Arbon and Tariq and others, talking to them about how they see that evolution. And the interesting thing is that no matter what we develop, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's virtual reality experiences and engagement in how we engage with our technology, all those things, in order to be valid, have to be validated manually by a human, right? Someone has to ensure that what automatically is being done works when you take away the automatic nature of what it's doing. So there's still a component of someone has to check and validate that the AI and the algorithms and all the things that they're doing are in fact giving you the correct results. And then the other piece is, there frankly is just a lot of stuff that even if a bot checks on a website, for example, for basic changes and differences, you still want a human to say, do I need to do 15 clicks and would two have been easier and how do you optimize it? So I think
absolutely
what it'll further just shift. And I call it, what's going to happen is testers, instead of just being functional testers or automation testers, they'll become artisanal testers.
Ooh,
right?
I like that.
Yeah. And that's kind of my new term I'm using for it, of is artisanal testing. And it's that artistic nature and creative nature of what only humans can bring in their logic and reasoning that artificial intelligence will never have, like we have.
You've been listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that connects you to extraordinary women for deep, inspiring conversations.